Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now? Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris. The list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with... It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks to everyone who checks in multiple times a week with all the interviews, to all the subscribers out there. Hopefully, if you get inspired, you can give the series a rating to maybe leave a review. And if you're not a subscriber, hit that subscribe button. Do not wait any longer. We premiere new interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and it's a great way to keep up with all of your favorite artists' comings and goings. Just head to wherever you get your podcast from, type in Kyle Meredith with, and subscribe away. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest is one of my all-time favorite artists, Kim Gordon. Yes, you know her from Sonic Youth. You might even know her from the art world that she's been such an integral part of for at least like 35, 40 years. And now she finally has her debut solo album, No Home Record. Kim and I are going to talk about the commercialization of art and writing in pop structures for the first time in like 10 years. As for the past few, she's also been in Body Head with Bill Nace. That's more of an improv, a noise group. So what's it been like coming back to these kind of structures? We'll get into her love and history of hip-hop from the New York scene in the 80s, recently becoming a Fleetwood Mac fan, and whether or not the lyrics on this record updates where she left off on her autobiography, Girl in a Band. She's also planning on taking this out on the road, and we'll talk about what that live band is going to be like and what that live show, what we can expect from that as well. Talking about this record, No Home Record, it's Kyle Meredith with Kim Gordon.
Hey.
I don't have to say that I'm a huge fan and I've been waiting for this record for a long time, but I am a huge fan and I've been waiting for this record for a long time, and it sounds so good. I'm so happy. Yeah, I'm so happy to hear this this solo record. Congratulations on this. It's awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah. Glad you like it.
Yeah, I was reading an interview with you recently as you're talking about this, and I'm taking it out of context a little bit, but you said art is at its most commercial right now. And I think you were talking about decorative arts along the lines of the Airbnb stuff, but I kind of wonder, though, if that's the case, do you find that that also influences how you come about to a record like this?
Well, I mean, I was you did take it out of context. I was talking about the New York art world as being more commercial than it's ever been, and maybe I was contrasting it with L.A., which isn't as commercial because Hollywood money isn't like Wall Street money. But, I mean, the Airbnb thing is more about, I guess, seeing how people's idea of art is, I mean, obviously they're decorating their house and they're treating art. There is a lot of high art that is basically decoration, or once you see it in a corporate lobby or something, it doesn't really have any, I don't know, often it just looks like decoration to me. Then, you know, when you use prints and reproductions of paintings, and it is becomes something else. And then when it matches the bedspread and the towels and the rugs, and you get kind of semblances of what might have been African art, which is now like a porcelain elephant or something, like in some, I don't know, it's just kind of interesting to me. Maybe I'm just a sociologist. And
well, I guess, and what I was, of course, trying to do was tie it back to the music, because, you know, in the past few years, you put out these really amazing records with Body Head, which, you know, finds you in more of a freeform structure. You know, it's a lot of improv in that, and this takes you back to the pops, you know, I guess we can call it as a pop structure. Is closer to what you're in now. And not that you have to pick one or the other, but do you find that you're more comfortable in one than the other?
Well, they're just different. I mean, playing with Bill Nace and Body Head, it's just kind of fun, pure fun. And, you know, it doesn't have like all these, I mean, it has its own built-in expectations, I guess. Maybe that's more for Bill, or that he knows the scene more of like noise music and all that. But I don't really have to pay attention to it. So it's kind of freeing for me. And I don't know, this is just kind of an experiment. I do like I don't listen to that much pop music, but, you know, I like rap and, you know, I like songs. And I listen to all kinds of super mellow music from the past, you know, whether it's Neil Young or Fleetwood Mac, Tusk, Steve Gunn, and Carvile too. You know, like I don't sit down and put on a noise record at home so much. It's more something I'd go see as for the experience of it.
Well, there's a Fleetwood Mac, you mentioned that. They get kind of a little nod in there. And it was Tusk, right? It was Tusk that you kind of, that led you to them?
Tusk, yeah.
That's an
rotated record.
It just turned 40. It's on its 40th anniversary, I think, this week. Not that that's here nor there, but it's kind of interesting that that's the one you centered in on. It's a cool record. It's different.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I mean, I hear Fleetwood Mac all over now. Like, it's like you can't escape it.
You'd also mention hip hop there for a second. Paprika Pony, I think, gets really close to, you know, with that beat that's happening behind that. It reminds me of the old school style. And you all were always early champions of hip hop and rap before it was widely accepted. Where did that come from for you? Was that just primarily a New York thing and your accessibility to it?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely, it was a New York thing. And then, you know, of course, God, I remember talking to Rick Rubin when he was still an NYU student living in a dorm, and he was telling me about he was going to record this, like, rap artist in his dorm room. And I was like, yeah, right, Rick. And, you know, he just became, like, this huge producer. But, no, you know, I like the LL Cool J's radio that was very minimal. And, you know, just like it's kind of in New York, you hear so much music pouring out of people's cars and just kind of a cacophony of mixed genres at times, you know, Madonna and then some rap and Run-DMC.
Was that actually a touch point when you were going into a song like Paprika Pony, or is it coincidence?
I mean, I kind of, you know, I relate to hip hop or rappers per se, as I'm not like the best singer or like a biggest range or big on melody, more of a rhythm kind of person. I like also that it's kind of punk, and that you don't have to be a muso or like know much about music. You can kind of make it through appropriation, and or at least that's when the way it started, and kind of, you know, had this do-it-yourself aspect to it, really, which was pretty punk. And I like a lot of Chicago hip hop.
You know, with the book now in the past, but do you find, does the lyrics update the story at all that's directly related to where you left off in the book?
No. I don't know. I didn't really like, I mean, I feel like that was several years ago. And I don't know. It has more to do with this kind of text I started writing or wrote for an art show about pitching a TV show, and just kind of, it was an excuse to make observations about other things and throw it into the mix. And I guess, yeah, I wasn't really thinking of it in that way. You could.
We do, because, you know, if you're a fan, we kind of hang on to the words, and of course we're going to try to draw the connections. So it's, but I don't have to be right, obviously. What about the live band? What's the live show on this gonna sound like? I mean, are you specifically mm-hmm. taking this album out on the road? And if so, who's playing with you?
Well, yeah, I have to put a band together. A couple of different people play drums, but there are only drums on a couple songs. So it'll probably have someone will be like kind of putting it together with me in terms of being able to use backing tracks and or files and mixed with some live musicians, and it might be more of a like an art performance vibe, but I don't know. It'll be weird.
I hope so. is there any reason to play any of your older songs that you took the vocals on for Sonic Youth when you're out there?
No. I mean, I can't really think of, I don't have any desire for that. I mean, even if I played all the songs on this record, it's only 40 minutes, so I have to think of some way to maybe write some new songs or something. But I can't really think of any Sonic Youth songs that I'd be able to pull off unless I just did it a cappella.
Right. I wouldn't complain. We're close to a bull in the heather here. It gets played all the time here in Louisville just because of the Kentucky Derby and everything. That's become a bit of a yearly anthem. And the mythology that runs out of that, because was it one of the guys from Pavement used to live over here? I forget which one. And there was always this...
Bob.
Yeah, Bob. And there was always a rumor that you all had come to one of his parties during the Derby. But did that ever happen?
No, never went to his party. So.
Dispelling that right now, finally.
But we did a lot of gigs with Pavement, so...
Could have worked
every
out.
Night was a party.
a ping pong party.
Yeah, kind of.
Just like with the table.
Yeah, I mean, well, they had on Lollapalooza, they had a ping pong table.
I think I've seen some of that video, the video footage. All right, congratulations on the record. I love it so much, and it's so great to hear from you, and I can't wait to catch one of these weird shows that you're going to put on.
Thanks, Kyle.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Kim.
Take care.
And a huge thanks, Kim Gordon. Once again, the debut solo album is called No Home Record, and it's out now. And it's one of my favorites of the year, so don't pass it up. Now, it was just last year in 2018 was the most recent time that Kim and I had caught up, which revolved around the 20th anniversary of the Sonic Youth record, 1,000 Leaves, and the 30th anniversary of the epic classic Daydream Nation. So we got to talk about both of those, as well as her projects in the art world, the improv sounds of the band Bodyhead, and the song Murdered Out. And it was the song Murdered Out that eventually led to this new solo record, so I thought this is an easy tie with the interviews. So check this one out as well to get even more of the story. It's part two of Kyle Meredith with Kim Gordon.
Oh, hey, hi.
Let's start out with just, you know, what you've been up to, because the last we heard of you musically was you put out the single Murdered Out, and that was 2016. And it was a one-off single, but I thought at the time, surely I thought, oh, this means that there's more on the way. Maybe, I don't know, a solo record or something. And that assumption was wrong.
Well, I am going to do a solo record.
I'm not sure. I don't think I'm doing it with that person, but who I worked with on that. But it's going to be the person I'm working with is really busy.
Right.
So, I don't know. It might take a while.
Yeah. So no timeline on that. But was that ever the thought when that song came out that that there was going to be more to go with it, or was that always meant to be a one-off?
Well, you know, I just really hadn't. it was just something that happened. So I hadn't really, planned anything more right then. I mean, it was kind of, everything takes so long. and now Bodyhead, we have a record coming out in July 13th on Matador. So,
oh, with Bodyhead?
Yeah. So if I do have a solo record, it'll be like next year.
You're also on the new Stephen Malcolmist record, I've heard. Which
Yes, I am.
What's your involvement there? What are you doing on that record?
Oh, I'm just doing a duet. It's like a sort of a faux country song about marriage, I think. Yeah, so that was fun.
Can you tell me about any more about the Bodyhead record while we're here? Is that still?
It's really heavy, and I don't know what to think of the Bodyhead record, but it's. It's quite different than the first one. So, yeah. I don't know. It's just heavy.
Let's do 1,000 Leaves because this album is turning 20 on May 12th. I don't feel like this is an album that gets celebrated very often. I mean, there's just so many, Sonic Youth records that people turn to. And this one's sort of good. I want to tell you, I had the poster of that on my wall for like most of my second half of my teenage years.
Oh, wow.
Take the trip down memory lane. Like, what comes to mind, if anything, when you think back to that record?
Well, I mean, I know that we were, I think it was very influenced by, having our own studio, and we'd been putting out, doing these kind of more instrumental, kind of just more experimental things on SYR. What's our last more kind of really song-oriented record? Was it Dirty? No, it was experimental jet set, I think.
Yeah, jet set and washing machine between this one and Dirty.
Washing machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then 1,000 Leaves was after Washing Machine, mm-hmm. or was it? Yeah, that's right. Anyway, I guess we sort of, Washing Machine, I'm talking about another record.
That's all right.
I think we felt like that was a really good recording experience. The recording felt very naturalistic. And, the whole kind of career of Sonic Youth, the whole time people would always say, oh, your records don't sound like you do live, and I think after a while we sort of gave up trying to do that, because also it's kind of dumb because people are listening to something on a giant speaker, and it's just a live experience. It's just totally different. I mean, some people really try to replicate their records, I guess. And that's like a point of kind of honor, or not honor, but to be exacting in that way. And we were never that sort of band anyway. So I think that though there was something about, the recordings that seemed always to separate us from the music, and the feeling of playing live and what the music sounded like playing live. So Washing Machine felt, even though it did have a lot of reverb on things, I think, it did feel like a kind of naturalist kind of sounding record. And so when we went back to our own studio, which actually we could have our own studio because we'd been toured Lollapalooza and we took some of that money and invested it and made our own studio. So we could then record more, and we started doing this like SYR record because that we didn't want to be put through some like big kind of record company machinery of promotion and blah, 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 blah. Because it's so frustrating. You have to wait so long to put a record out. Anyway, so 1,000 Leaves, I think, was very influenced by that process.
When I look back, especially, 1998, I thought the alt scene, that you guys had released Goo and Dirty in, that sort of drifted out by that point. We're getting into the late 90s, almost to the rap rock and cock rock takeover of radio and everything.
Right.
But I thought, it almost was probably a nice thing for you all, because once that certain spotlight had kind of shifted that way, it seems like it would take the pressure off. Because when I listen to this now, when I listen to 1,000 Leaves now, it almost sounds like one of the first times that Sonic Youth sounded like you were really comfortable and on your own speed.
Yeah, that's what I mean by naturalistic or something. Like, we weren't sort of trying something out that was out of our comfort zone in a way. I mean, seriously, we like to record at Sirius Sound because they had like a 2-inch and, it's very analog sounding and all that. But You know, I even remember the last record we recorded there. I guess it was experimental, like working with Butch Vig. We kind of got into this thing of saying, well, that's good enough, you know, instead of going back and redoing take after take. Because I feel like with like Dirty and Goo, you know, we basically really took the rock thing as far as we could and then ultimately found it sort of less satisfying when we saw where it was kind of going. Like you were saying also, like we kind of just hit a wall with it and then it's almost like we just became more introverted or something. Yeah, so that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, that's when I started loving Sonic Youth the most, when you became introverted.
Oh, God. I mean, I don't even remember what's on that record or what it sounds like, to tell you the truth.
Well, there's three songs that I'll bring up. First, Sunday was the big single off of it, was, I guess, the only single off of it, which, as I look back on now, I don't remember seeing it, but you had Macaulay Culkin in the video?
Right, yeah. It was sort of Thurston and Macaulay Culkin. Okay. I think Harmony shot it, Harmony Korine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see him.
And it was kind of like he had this idea he wanted to do, so.
You know, a couple of your songs that I'll point out, especially because there's always, with a lot of your lyrics, they've held on, they've aged well, and I'm going to say they aged well in really fortunate and interesting ways, because the first track is, I'm going to try to say it, Contre le Sexisme, which I think transfers to Against Sexism, and then the Female Mechanic, and listening to those now, and the things that you were talking about, and all the way back, especially to your very famous line and cool thing that people are holding up on posters everywhere now. You know, this all eventually comes out to the Me Too movement that's been in the last year or 2 years and everything. And I don't know if you have a reaction to that, a feeling of that, but that's got to have some kind of positive effect on you, that I would think.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I actually, but it's sort of like the way the media works, and it's just sort of like, well, sexism didn't just happen now, you know, so, you know, and I don't know, I guess when we signed to major label, I think I really felt like, okay, I actually have a platform here that like, I can write a song about anything. And it almost kind of, I felt challenged by it, like, I, you know, to step up to the plate or something, like so many people write love songs or that, and it's kind of like, well, as a woman, I had so many things I could write songs about as subject matter. And like there was like swimsuit issue, you know, like right after we signed a Geffen, I think there was kind of a big A&R person who was called out for sexual harassment. And it was kind of a big deal. I think we felt, not only had we signed to, like, you know, accused of selling out, signing to a major label, but it was like one that had this particular scumbag, you know, but of course it was just like, he was probably the tip of the iceberg, or, you know, like no one just talked about it. But, you know, I really deeply felt like the sexism coming from this corporate world, and, you know, things like they'd have like secretary day, but they wouldn't necessarily like give help kind of nurture secretaries into other jobs, or, you know, like promoting them, or, you know, and, you know, so that was kind of, I think it's funny. It's just funny how things come around. They don't go away, you know, and, but I actually had totally forgotten that I'd written that song. Also Female Mechanic, you know,
what the nice thing, I guess, that I'm trying to say with that is, you know, when we would see those stories in the 90s, it was almost like those people, even if they got in trouble, it would just be like a stern slap on the wrist a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know about the situation you're specifically speaking to, but a lot of times that happened. Whereas now it feels like, you know, whether the huge ball keeps rolling in the way that we all hope it does, but, you know, those mountains are starting to crumble. And like I said, for you to be such a voice of that, and interestingly, with words you said 20 years ago and 25 years ago, to still have such an impact and to be so inspiring, you know, to women marching and you know, traveling across the country to walk on Washington.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Like, it was so funny because it was just such a, that inspiration for the Cool Thing lyrics came from a couple different sources, and I almost meant it like, it was just like one of those lyrics on the, they did actually eventually, I guess now they mean to. But I was kind of thinking of I was inspired by a Raymond Pettibone film and Jane Fonda and L. Cool J. You know, like it was, but yeah. I mean, it is interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you really think it's, I just feel like, I guess I'm a little pessimistic though. I just kind of feel like people have such short attention spans, and it is like all the sexual harassment stories coming out. It's all kind of built on like such a culture of sexism, you know, that it's so deeply ingrained and it's genetically ingrained. And I don't know, I just hope it still keeps moving forward with some momentum, you know?
Yeah. I think it's just everyone's so starved for that change to finally happen because it's been so long coming. It's such a long time coming.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, but at the same time,
it's been repressed so long.
Yeah, at the same time, we have a dude in the office who has been sued by dozens of women, and nothing will happen. Nothing will happen.
Yeah, because there's so many kind of white male kind of, you know, small thinkers in the office. And
I don't think we're going to solve the world's problem with that, but I do appreciate you in that sort of idea right there, as I know a lot of folks do.
That's great. Thanks.
So let's turn to another record then, which you pointed out to me. I wasn't paying attention to the 30-year anniversary, but in October, Daydream Nation turns 30 years. And I feel like everything's been said about that record because there are literally books written about that record. How does it sit with you in a catalog, you know, to be held on such a pedestal like that? Like, do you have the same emotions that I think people give that album rise to?
You know, I sort of didn't until we, you know, because once a record's done, you just kind of, you sort of have to forget about it, and then you go out and you play the songs and they take on sort of a new life of their own. But when we did relearn that record and start playing it live again, it had such a different feeling than all our other songs after that. And, you know, it's like it's so dense, and it was actually just such an intense thing to play. But like listening to it, I don't know, it's not as, I didn't get the sense of the songs individually of having that much power, but actually playing the songs was really hard. And in the sense that it was just really a lot of energy, and maybe it was also coming out of being influenced by hardcore and just, you know, super like dense kind of music that was around us.
Yet at that time it ends up being, you know, I guess your most accessibly as a pop record that you guys had ever done, which is interesting that's what the influences were coming from, you know, that you ended up on the charts with that record.
Yeah, it's weird.
Were you aware? I guess I should say, when did you start to become aware that it was taking on that life that it eventually did?
I don't know. You know, it was just a kind of gradual, I guess, because people would mention it as, you know, our best record or something.
Yeah. It's in the Library of Congress now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was a moment. I forgot. No, I remember, being like, we're in Japan or something when they had the Paz and Jap poll, and it was like number one. And I remember being just completely surprised.
I don't know. I mean, to have, you know, we talk about these records, to have something that dominated your life for 30 years and then for it to be done and gone. Do you feel the absence of Sonic Youth, or is it still people like me making it constantly circle around you?
I mean, I don't feel the absence of it because I kind of felt like we sort of took it as far as we could. And I don't know, also I'm just kind of sort of busy with other things. Now able to like pursue making art more, which is kind of the most important thing to me. And also I love playing with Bill. Like I love Bodyhead. You know, I just kind of just, I love the freedom of it.
And that's, you know, I'll try not to make that part of this interview too awkward either, because, you know, it's well written about how Sonic Youth kind of came to an end and why it came to an end, you know, without getting into your personal life. But that was sort of the question, you know, like, had Sonic Youth made their final record one way or the other? Was that happening regardless?
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. You know, I think, you know, one gets, you know, I think that we had a lot of good times and good moments, and kind of amazing that the band was able to become as big as it was. You know, I just can't imagine what it would be like starting a band now that was, you know, writing songs or indie rock or whatever. And like, I just kind of feel pretty much like, you know, dynamics in a band get old, and it's kind of like, it's better to stop before, you know, it's just all the good times get forgotten, you know?
Right. Right. There's a lot of great music in there. I certainly do appreciate every bit of it. I'm always excited about what you're doing next. Like I said, I thought Murdered Out was I was so taken aback by it. One, it just kind of came out of nowhere, but it was such a good song and so great to hear you sort of in that style and mode as well. Uh-huh. So,
yeah, no, I would like to do more actually with that producer too. I think, you know, I probably will, but I think there'll be like one-offs or something.
Well, I thank you for the time, especially you gave me a lot of time here. I really appreciate that. But
oh, sure.
Yeah, and I look forward to the new Body Head. So maybe we can catch up more when that happens. And we'll
yeah, definitely.
We'll get Bill on the phone too and make it a big thing.
Cool. All right.
Well, take care. Is there anything else we should know about? Actually, I should ask, you just did an art show, so I didn't know if you had any more of those coming up. That was
oh yeah. Well, it's up until the 28th in LA. There's like there's actually a kind of a narration part to it, as well as a painting and sculpture, and there's like sound effects in the room and stuff.
Where is it?
It's at this gallery in LA called Rena Spalling's Fine Art. They have one in New York, and then they share the space with another gallery from Mexico City. They kind of, every other month, they curate a show. And yeah, I'm really happy with it.
Yeah, and how long is that up?
Till April 28th.
Well, awesome. I don't think I can get to April in that time, but I hope some of our listeners can. So,
yeah.
Awesome, Kim. Well, thank you so much again, and it was great talking to you.
You too. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Kim Gordon, that's back from 2018 right there, as we got to talking about what would eventually become that solo record and those anniversaries of A Thousand Leaves and Daydream Nation. Now, back it up just a few years right before that, and it was the first time that I got to talk with Kim and Bill Nace of Body Head. They were together. We were backstage at the Big Ears Festival down in Tennessee, and we got to chat about the debut Body Head record called Coming Apart. So I'm going to drop that one in here as well. It's part three with Kim Gordon.
Hi.
So we're at the Big Ears Festival here in Knoxville, Tennessee, which you guys are a part of, and it seems like that there is no more perfect festival created that you guys could be a part of than what's going on right here. I don't know what we say. It's like innovators or those folks who are skirting the art and pop world, and you fit in.
Yeah, we're just sort of zooming around the edges of everything.
Yeah. Well, do you see yourself as part of a club that's going on here?
Yeah, kind of. Like, I mean, we're literally like, yeah, we're kind of...
I don't know what are we.
Oh, we don't have to categorize what you are.
We never feel like we're actually in the club, wherever the club, whatever the club
yeah.
is.
Yeah, I just don't see like we're, for a lot of festivals, there's you couldn't take a yearbook photo of it, but this one, it seems like you could actually take a nice yearbook photo of
yeah.
everyone, and it's
no,
going to make
great.
Sense.
Right,
you know?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's this type of music. It's what's going on here that I guess it's... I mean, could you ever imagine anything like this ever going... Mainstream's probably not the right word, but somewhere like the accessibility and everything, because there's really interesting stuff. And I guess what I'm getting to is, you know, you guys aren't what I'd say a rock band, and everybody here is not a rock band, but in the realm of rock and pop, you know, you hit those walls every few years, and it takes something moving it forward, and it feels like we could get something out of this. These are the artists that are trying that, but do you ever feel like these are the artists who could ever be... I don't know, what's a good example?
I think that idea, though, of the mainstream kind of breaking into that in that way is a little, like, not as relevant
yeah.
nowadays. It's more about, like, access,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, easier than it used to be to kind of, you know, check out a wide array of things.
I mean, I guess you don't need a radio hit anymore just to be...
Right, right.
To make a living, you know.
Or to not make a living.
Right.
Did you make a living off your radio hits? That's a good question.
We didn't have any radio hits.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, I think that there's something interesting about you know, maybe eccentricity is a kind of a way you could describe even some of the bands that are playing.
Yeah.
You know, like television or...
Right, right.
But I think it's just kind of accumulated, people getting sort of years of that, you know, dissonance and mm-hmm. that kind of music, like, filtering up. Mm-hmm. And, I think basically anything can also be marketed.
Sure.
You know, like the Red Bull Academy did this festival that, I mean, I don't know how many people actually went. It wasn't like Lollapalooza or anything.
It was
but they called it drone music, which I would never, I think, right. Very specifically drone music as like, minimalist classical music mm-hmm. Or the Velvet. I guess I can see how people think of the Velvet Underground as drone music, but I don't think of that.
I don't think of it as drone. Well, I mean, we look at it as history books now, so it's through that filter.
Yeah,
you know,
but people seem to have glommed onto that word as something that is...
Well, didn't we just call it shoegaze at one point? There was a catch-all with shoegaze as well, that if it
Well, that was more pop, though.
Yeah, slow and murky, and it's like, it was shoegaze, you know?
Yeah.
I just think having improvised music at a festival is kind of, you know, not the norm.
It's not jam band improvised music.
Right.
It's not like free jazz or something like that.
Right.
No, but we're improvised, and I'm not sure. I imagine the Hino trio is maybe has some improvisation going on.
Yeah.
So I just think to have that at a festival is pretty, you know, not usual, which is nice.
Well, that's a great lead-in, actually, to your guys' record and everything. So it's the debut Buddyhead record. And there is a certain amount of improv into that. Yeah, and I've read about, you know, that there was some structure to it, but there was also a lot of free range, and how that plays towards the live show. Because when did it come out? I mean, this record's now what's
September?
Yeah, so whatever, 7 months or whatever that is. DJ math. it's somewhere in the 12 months or whatever. So I mean, it couldn't have started out anything like the record. But now, what are those? Are they completely different? Have you guys found that there is any kind of structure to these songs on any given night?
Well, we're really not playing this. I mean, it literally, the record literally was completely improvised.
Okay.
And then, including the lyrics and the vocals, mm-hmm. but then I went back and overdubbed some other lyrics, and we did some shaping and a little bit of editing and a couple of guitar overdubs, but...
you're not playing
that. The only thing that remains is, we could never recreate it.
Sure.
It was completely... made up in the moment. So, and it's our whole career is that is what we do live on stage.
Yeah.
So the only thing that's really carried over are some lyric ideas,
but
basically. But as far
or
as
just things that we do because it's who we are and that's how we play.
Yeah, like our vocabulary playing and you know we're so kind of used to playing together that. So I like to think of it as sort of scripted improvisation, mm-hmm. but it's really unscripted improvisation, really.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's what the set list looks like. Like, how does the set list look? You know, does it say abstract on it?
You're
like,
no set list.
That's what I'm getting.
But when we tour in Europe, we for publishing, they always want the names of the songs, so we just put down the names of the songs on the record. I guess.
They wouldn't know.
What are you
going to do?
It's
funny. Bill, I know that you've said in the previous bands you didn't work a lot with vocalists. It wasn't a lot of vocalists. Now, once again, you've had time. You know, what has that been like for you? And have you found new tricks over these months, you know, to how that shapes?
New tricks, how?
Of working with it, because you play to voice. I read an interview that said you've learned how to play to voice, and it's a very different
thing. Oh, no, I wasn't saying I learned how to play to it, more just that it's changed how I play with other people or how I approach it. But, you can kind of get away with more as well in terms of, because the way Kim sings, it kind of ties it together, mm-hmm. and I think it gives it that kind of song quality.
It's the Lebowski rug.
Yeah. Exactly like
Bill's
that.
Bill's favorite movie.
But, so we can, I don't mean get away, but we can kind of work with more abstract musical pieces that then the vocals kind of tie it together and make it something that I don't think it would be without the vocals. So just for me, I had never really played with that much, so it was just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd played with vocalists, but more people that did also, like, kind of really just... you know, abstract kind of extended technique type of stuff.
I mean, there's a million genres out there, and kind of putting in a box of just what we know, you know, usually as rock pop, it's so foreign to hear, like, someone talking about not playing with a vocalist that much.
You know, right,
and,
right.
And learning it this far into a career.
Right.
The exciting thing about Bodyhead, and I guess with what you guys are saying, too, it doesn't really seem like there's a roadmap much at all. I mean, I don't know how you see it. Is this a project, or is this your band?
It's our band.
It's band.
It's the band. Is it the band right now, or
we had the name Star Wars. Like, let's make it.
No, it's a band. So.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I said. You know, and Kim, maybe it's because you know you've been through many projects that we call projects. You know, and I guess that's the splitting hairs, the definitions between what's a band and what's a project. Mm-hmm. And you know, yeah. Do we get to have more Bodyhead records? You know, down the line and that type of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really done that many projects.
I think project gets used projects. When there's like a main. You know, it's like Free Kitten was a band,
sure,
but Sonic Youth was happening, so then people kind of...
Sonic Youth was a project, Free Kitten was a band.
Exactly, yeah, right. I mean, it's all like where your entry point into that is.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think it means that much.
Yeah. It might not happen on this level, and, you know, maybe this is an awkward question with it, but, you know, have you had any problem finding your place, given, you know, Sonic Youth and the history of everything like that, you know, coming from you... Where you are, because there's a spotlight, obviously, when you walk out, and this is a new band, it's Bodyhead, but it's here's Kim Gordon. Have you found any problem finding a place in it?
Finding a place.
I don't know if saying in the spotlight is the right thing, but just saying, like, this is a duo and not, once again, a project.
No. I mean, I think because it's a duo, there's not much of a issue with that. I mean,
it
kind of is what it is.
Yeah. Well, Kim, for you then, was it, you know, any means for reinvention? Because there is similarities in sound to what we're used to hearing from you. But did you ever step out and said, I could completely reinvent myself with this?
Well, I didn't really think about it so consciously. I just felt like I wanted just, you know, I liked playing with Bill and... I just thought, oh, great, now I can just play exactly what I want to play.
I'm the captain now.
Playing with only one other person, it's just easier to focus on the music, for one thing. And also, I don't know, I just thought, we're just going to make this music. We didn't really think beyond just going down in the basement and starting to record and then starting to do some shows.
People always want like a narrative of something that's beyond just like...
This is what happened.
I like to play music you know.
We have to fill space sometime.
It's true.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was thinking more, I would just concentrate on art, but I did miss playing, and it was fun to do something I thought, you know, I wouldn't have to promote.
Yeah, and here you are.
But... yeah, and then if you like it, then you want people to come see it.
Sure. So. Well, we love it, and that's the great thing about this. I mean, luckily it worked. Do you mind if I ask how the book's going? Because there's going to be a bio, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going.
Yeah?
Actually, my deadline is April.
the way you're saying that doesn't sound too promising.
Let's just say I should be at the hotel writing.
Yeah. Has it been surprising at all how much people, from the moment we heard there was going to be a bio, they were like, oh, I mean, salivating, at the actual story.
I mean, it's not going to be a Sonic Youth bio.
Sure.
So, I mean, there's, you know, things about, of course, writing about different songs and recording and different stories about that, but its purpose isn't to make a Sonic Youth fan totally happy.
Yeah. So you went into it actually.
So just set your bar
just
low.
Like the band.
I want everyone to set their bar low.
Yeah. Did you go into it with that idea? Yeah. Did you have that idea when you went into it, when they said, hey, let's write a book? Did you have to think, what is the book? What's the angle?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you would have to instead of just...
Yeah, you make a proposal.
It. Sure. Yeah, I don't know the book world. Yeah. I don't know how it works. Have you read all of the other like unauthorized biographies that have your life in it?
No.
Did you ever open any of those? Because there's quite a few out there.
They're all really awful. Pretty
are they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're boring. I mean, the only one that's actually... I mean, they're not awful, but they're just... You know, they don't have any context to them.
Yeah.
Pretty much. The best one is actually this catalog, Sensational Fix, from a show art exhibit that unfortunately didn't come here because the recession was going on. But they went to 7 or 8 museums in Europe, and it was an exhibit that had to do with artists we were influenced by and collaborated with.
Yeah.
And just, it was less really about Sonic Youth, but it had individually some of our artwork and some ephemera and stuff from Sonic Youth. But it was a kind of an interesting context for the band, and it's really the best book on Sonic Youth. I think Byron Cole is going to write the ultimate.
Yeah, it's going to be the one.
You know, like, leave those details in.
One of these days. Well, good luck on the April deadline, and thanks for giving us Body Head, both of you guys.
Thanks.
It was great meeting you both.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
Kim Gordon, Bill Nace, the band Body Head. That comes from a 2014 interview talking about their record called Coming Aparts. And that does it for this episode, too. Once again, huge thanks to Kim Gordon. The new record is out now. Do check it out. And thanks to you for listening all this way, too. Don't forget, before you get out of here, if you're a subscriber, maybe you can give the series a rating wherever you're listening from. Leave a review if you can do that. If you're not a subscriber, hit that subscribe button, because we put out a new interview every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So keep up with us. Just type in Kyle Meredith With wherever you're listening to your podcast from. Hit that subscribe button right now. You can also do that in places like Spotify and YouTube as well. After that, head to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's an hour full of song premieres, of music news, anniversary spins, and even more interviews. It's WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. You can also find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith and Facebook/Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown in the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM. Make it legendary. BetMGM and game system. You to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.